Welcome to another edition of KUAR's Week in Review podcast. On this week's program, we discuss a faith summit held by Governor Asa Hutchinson, bringing together leaders from the faith community in Arkansas, looking at problems of foster care and reentry for former inmates. There was a disappointing economic development announcement this week. We'll discuss that as well. We look at how the state will implement a clean power plan from the Environmental Protection Agency. And we talk about the visit of a fourth Republican presidential candidate to Arkansas, Dr. Ben Carson, as well as a new appointee to the Arkansas Supreme Court. It's all coming up on this week's program of KUAR's Week in Review podcast. I'm Chris Hickey. We did things a little differently this week, recording our podcast in different segments at different times. You'll hear from our reporter and anchor, Sarah Weitz-Kotacek, as well as our news director, Michael Hiblin, who's in the host chair.
There was disappointment among many this week as the state learned that Lockheed Martin will not be landing a major military contract to build the next generation of combat vehicle. On Tuesday, the U.S. Army announced it was awarding the contract for this Joint Light Tactical Vehicle to a Wisconsin-based company, Oshkosh Corporation. The contract was valued at $6.75 billion, and Lockheed Martin was one of three companies competing for the project. And in fact, the Arkansas legislature had in May even approved issuing bonds for the project. Up to $87 million in an incentive package was going toward this project if it indeed came to Arkansas. But military officials decided not to award it to Lockheed Martin, which would have built this vehicle at its facilities in Camden. And big disappointment there, would have brought 500 jobs to the state. Sarah, this week you spoke with the governor about this, who expressed his disappointment. What did he have to say?
Michael, yeah, the governor said that the state had done everything that it could and that he wasn't sure why Lockheed Martin hadn't gotten the contract, but that the state was well positioned to be competitive using those funds approved by the legislature to go for similar projects, even perhaps a different super project.
First of all, the state did the right thing. We would have really felt bad had we not stepped up to the plate and given them a competitive price point for the competition with the other states. And so even though we did not win that contract federally, the investment by Lockheed Martin in Arkansas will pay off in the future. And obviously, we had $87 billion in bonds that was devoted to this. That's freed up for new investments down the road. We're not going to stop. We're going to continue the effort to bring those jobs and even a super project to Arkansas.
Mike Preston, the head of the Economic Development Commission of the state, had a similar comment Wednesday. This bond, the $87 million, was approved by bipartisan support in the legislature. So it seems like a bit of a blow to the state that this happened.
But the governor mentioned this can go toward other projects. Do you know how that would work? What exactly this $87 million could be redirected toward, I assume, other kinds of economic development projects?
Well, I'm not entirely sure, but my understanding is that the funds were directed more generally for an economic development project and that it was understood that this was intended for Lockheed Martin, but I suppose he's saying it could be applied to any project.
On Monday, the head of the Arkansas Department of Environmental Quality, as well as the State Public Service Commission, met with reporters to discuss how they're planning to abide by a final federal rule on reducing carbon emissions at the state's power plants. Chris, you covered this hearing. This comes while the Attorney General is appealing this and challenging the state having to meet this, but it sounds like the state is making plans to move forward on this.
Right. So the Federal Clean Power Plan was proposed by the EPA last summer. And overall, in that initial proposal, they said that U.S. power plants would have to reduce their carbon emissions by something on the order of 32 to 33% by the year 2030. Now, that struck a chord with a lot of utilities across the land and a lot of business interests and environmental groups, all with different kind of perspectives on this. And it also began a series of stakeholder meetings in the state here where the ADEQ and the Public Service Commission brought together these different utilities and environmental groups and, you know, folks like the Chamber of Commerce and different cities to talk about how exactly Arkansas was going to address this plan. Now, back then, it was still an initial proposal. During these stakeholder meetings, which occurred about every month, starting last summer through the fall, the different interests would kind of outline their comments and their suggestions or their criticisms of the plan. And eventually those comments were submitted to the EPA last year, at the end of last year. And the EPA considered them, and they just released their final plan earlier this month. Now, the difference between the initial proposal for our state and the final plan is pretty significant. Initially, the EPA wanted Arkansas to reduce carbon emissions at its power plants by 44% by the year 2030. With the revised rule, considering some of the comments that we submitted, there's now a target of 36% by 2030. And this would affect roughly 19 power plants across the state. With, you know, and each power plant has several units. There are about 5 coal power plants in the state. Anyway, so Becky Keough and Becky Keough, director of the Arkansas Department of Environmental Quality, and Ted Thomas, the chairman of the Public Service Commission here, held a joint news conference at the ADEQ headquarters in North Little Rock, kind of responding to that latest, that finalized rule that the EPA submitted to the states. And they're basically talking about where does the state go from here. And here's Becky Keough elaborating on that.
Our review will focus on a number of areas. What is the best path forward for the state? How the plan will affect grid reliability and the environment? Whether the timeline provides sufficient time to address gaps in infrastructure and assess those environmental impacts related and obtain approval of projects based on those needs.
So basically they're saying that they will resume these stakeholder meetings beginning in October. And once they do that, they'll kind of determine over the next few months whether or how the state will abide by the plan, addressing things like cost to ratepayers, you know, like she said, grid reliability, and, you know, the actual meeting the various deadlines along the way. A couple of things also had changed with the plan. There is an extension of the deadline for submission of the state plan. So our state has to submit a plan for meeting these rules by September of next year. And the start of the compliance deadline is also extended by 2 years. So initially, in 2020, the state would have had to begin showing a reduction in emissions. And now that's extended to 2022. And Chairman Thomas emphasized that this new rule was welcomed with some relief. And he explains here some of the reasons why.
They're less stringent for a few reasons. First of all, the EPA employed a regional average, which brought our requirement down. That didn't help our neighbors, but it brought our requirement down, and some of our neighbors' requirement went up. What's the basis for the change? The first thing would be litigation risk. I think the EPA changed its rule to cut down the litigation risk. There'd still be litigation, but they wanted to face a different series of arguments, so they went to this regional averaging to arrive at state-specific goals. Second was, as Director Keogh mentioned, our comments. The EPA listened to some of our comments, particularly with respect to the Turk plant.
The John W. Turk plant in southwest Arkansas was built, or construction there was finished in 2012. The baseline projections that the EPA had initially offered were based on 2012 levels, but the Turk plant went online in 2013, and the ADEQ and the PSC had submitted comments, well, you know, the Turk plant is a coal plant, but it's one of the more cleaner burning ones in the country. A lot of the coal plants in Arkansas are very old and very dirty, and when considered alone, the amount of emissions per megawatt generated is very high. But when you consider the Turk plant, it brings that average down. And so when the EPA listened to that comment and revised the rule, they basically said that, you know, we can include this, the average emissions, including this Turk plant. So that was one reason why the emissions target dropped to 36%. And he mentioned litigation risk. As we said, our state attorney general, Leslie Rutledge, had joined a lawsuit against the proposed rules that a federal judge threw those out. But she also, with this finalized rule, joined another lawsuit with 14 other states, and they're asking a federal judge for a stay on the finalized rule. And there are a lot of different, like, moving parts to this, obviously, and you know, there's so many different aspects, and it'll affect so much of the grid and the power situation in Arkansas. Basically, it would allow the state to move more towards renewables and clean natural gas. There are several clean natural gas power plants in the state that could expand. But also, this kind of dovetails with a proposal by Entergy recently responding to another EPA plan to reduce regional haze in the area in national wilderness areas. And Entergy had proposed closing down its White Bluff coal plant, which is a very old plant. And here's Becky Keogh talking about how that proposal kind of relates to this other clean power plan that the EPA is asking us to implement.
Looking at that retirement of coal at that single coal plant will be significant. I think Entergy's done some evaluation on this. I don't know if they're they're waiting to see how it plays into the overall model, I suspect, before they make any commitments about what to do. But I think it will get us largely to that 2030 goal, if that is the case, based on other factors, you know, assuming nothing else comes up that would somehow detract from that.
And Keogh said we're in a pretty good position to meet all these emissions reductions targets. She said even by the initial start by 2020, the state will have, by projections, reduced its emissions by about 13%. So we'll see in the upcoming stakeholders meetings how exactly the state will go about meeting these goals.
Yeah, and Chris, as you mentioned, the White Bluff plant, this was one that Entergy said would have costed more than $1 billion to install these scrubbers to clean this. One of the dirtiest power plants in the state. And the news that Entergy was going to close this is planning to, even though it would take place more than a decade away from now, was really celebrated by environmentalists.
Yeah, and you can kind of see there how it's becoming more apparent that it might become more cost-effective to switch, for utilities to switch over to different types of cleaner burning technologies, not just cleaner burning coal technologies, but shifting over to natural gas or wind and solar. I think Entergy also has recently proposed a contract with a provider of solar power. Arkansas has so many different sources of energy production that it'll be interesting to see in the years to come how exactly things switch over.
And you mentioned the part about the talk that ratepayers may end up footing the bill to abide by these new federal regulations. That's been a key argument from the utility companies against this. But did the PSC or ADEQ officials discuss that, what impact meeting these guidelines or regulations may have for just regular customers?
Yeah, see, I don't know if there's any clear idea yet. They didn't say specifically, you know, and give any particular numbers as to how, you know, ratepayers might be affected. It all kind of depends on a lot of things. You know, there's power sharing agreements between the state and entities and utilities here and entities in other states where and there's also issues with, you know, closing coal, introducing more renewables, switching over to natural gas. There's so many moving parts that it's hard to predict exactly how much ratepayers will be affected. Of course, that was, yes, as you said, one of the main comments of utilities leading up to this and after the initial proposal. And I think one of the main criticisms that utilities had before was that there wasn't enough time to meet these guidelines. And now there's a little bit more time, so that may give them some wiggle room to find more cost-effective options. So it's hard to say, but we'll get a better idea definitely when these stakeholders' meetings commence.
This week, a two-day summit was held in Little Rock with faith leaders from across the state. About 600 people took part. The summit was called for by Governor Asa Hutchinson to address the state's overcrowded foster care system and the 43% recidivism rate for those leaving prison. Sarah, you covered at least part of this. What were some of the ideas brought up?
Well, Michael, to put some of the issues that the governor and faith leaders are discussing in context, about a quarter of the state's 4,000 foster kids currently don't have a foster home, and the state's prison crowd overcrowding is at a peak. And while the governor approved funding last week and the legislature also for expanding prisons, and the Department of Correction has requested more money, overcrowding is really driven by this recidivism rate and by the reentry rate of parolees who are getting put back in prison right when they come out. So the governor is reaching out to faith leaders from around the state. As you said, about 600 attended, and he said that in his discussions with them, he learned a lot from their perspective about some of these issues.
I learned a lot more about DHS's challenge. I learned about what is already happening in terms of the faith community and the efforts that they have, and then had some ideas for the future. I didn't share all of them, but there's some things that we can do in the future that can add to what we've done today. So a lot to follow up on, but time well spent.
So this is a preliminary stage of discussion with faith leaders about what their congregations might do, whether it be taking in foster kids into their own homes or starting reentry centers that may be eligible for contracts with the state to help prisoners get jobs and develop life skills. It was sort of a greeting of sorts and an initial reach out. So the governor plans to collect surveys from everyone who participated and stay in touch with them, and then in another 6 months reach out and have the same individuals who actually have taken action come back and have another meeting.
I intend to have a governor's job fair down the road and work with the steering committee to accomplish this, because I think that will help educate employers as to what's available there, what steps they can take to make sure they put ex-offenders in right positions and they have the right tests to measure where they should be. Encourage them because of what other employers have done and the experience they've had. Some of that's been emphasized here. So we need to open up the doors of employment for these that are willing to work, And then we need to look at are there additional obstacles or whether there's any tax incentives that should be there. I don't think that's absolutely necessary. People want workers out there and good workers. We need to match them up with those that are coming out and have the skills and willing to work.
So the governor was asking, among other things, that clergymen and women ask their congregation to help consider employing former inmates. And then another important step in that process is ensuring that people are prepared to take on a job and that they have mentorship. And I think that the pretty broad-ranging requests he's making, and sort of general at this point, from faith leaders, but I think really it's just getting that commitment there. And of course, the whole other side of the situation is the foster system, and the governor has recently appointed a senior advisor from his office. This was coming out of the DHS report that he commissioned a few months ago to look into the foster system in the state. And then one of his points of response was to appoint Betty Anderson Guman. So she was at the summit as well and is keeping track of who was there and what they might be able to do as far as helping with the foster system.
So this will give us a sense of who wants to do what and a connection. On the governor's website, there'll be a section on child welfare, and it will have the Paul Vincent report, of course, and then all the things that we're doing, so updates and that kind of thing. And the idea then is after about 6 months, which would be January, February, to have another summit, but only with those churches who are actively involved, churches that have done something as a result of this.
She mentioned the Paul Vincent report. That's the overarching report on DHS and some of its successes and failures over meeting the needs of foster kids, which revealed this rate of about a quarter of the kids actually not having a real place to go. Some of them were sleeping overnight in offices, DHS offices, for lack of foster homes. So revealed a real need there. Juanita Yule is from a local congregation in Little Rock, World of Outreach Christian Church, and they're opening two reentry homes for female inmates coming out, and actually are sort of combining these two issues by looking into ways to also connect those women with foster parents for their children if they have them.
So I wanted to learn more about it because in this, we're going to be able to place children in homes as their mothers or fathers or whoever will be able to enter back into life. So we want to be able to care for their children. So this was really informative for me.
I asked Ms. Guman what the diversity was among clergy and whether she was concerned about the possibility that some, you know, former inmates or foster children who are relying on faith leaders as sort of an intermediary between the state and themselves, if there could be any potential issues that arose. And she said, well, it's a diverse group and they don't quite have statistics on those numbers yet, but she did say that she believes that it's representative of a wide range of faiths.
Yeah, we did mention last week that there was one judge calling on black churches to boycott this. Do we know? Did many, or did you notice, were there many? Did it seem like there was any groups not represented, at least from your time there?
Well, I have to say, as far as just being an observer, that it seemed racially to be a fairly diverse crowd. I'd say there were a fair number of African-American leaders there. I've heard the governor use the term churches multiple times, and based on the makeup of the committee that he put together to form this summit that were largely Christian, I would say it seems like a predominantly Christian effort.
Well, they must have accomplished something if they're planning another summit here in 6 months, at least with those churches who took some steps, took action after this one.
It's interesting to talk to participants about their plans for reentry centers. I asked them, you know, how they were planning on funding it. Would it be funded through the state? And they said, no, we don't know yet. So they're sort of launching into some new territory as well themselves.
Arkansas had another visit by a Republican presidential candidate, marking the fourth candidate now who has come through the state. Chris Hickey, you covered the rally by Ben Carson on the steps of the state capitol, and he's really gotten a lot of attention since that first debate on Fox News. His poll numbers have steadily been rising. Did he get a good turnout there at the Capitol?
Yeah, there are hundreds of people there, just from all over. I spoke to one woman from Bryant who came, and I think there are others from around central Arkansas. Yeah, as you mentioned, he's the fourth candidate for the Republican nomination to come through. In the introduction, Doyle Webb, the Republican Party chairman here in Arkansas, said that pointed to maybe the political influence that Arkansas is gaining among, you know, the Republican Party nationwide, that, you know, this is the fourth candidate. I mean, I don't know how valid that is, but he may also be referring to the fact that Arkansas is going to be an early primary state next year, joining a lot of other southern states in the SEC primary in early March. And so people here might have more of a say in the nomination than was the case before, although Arkansas still has relatively few electoral votes. But Ben Carson came through, spoke to a few hundred people. Of course, he's famous for being a neurosurgeon at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore. He earned the Presidential Medal of Freedom. He's written books, kind of been a public figure for some time, but not a politician. And that's something he was quick to emphasize. And one of the other things he emphasized in sort of crafting his personal political narrative and his worldview was his upbringing, which he grew up relatively poor child in Detroit, and he talked about the influence of his mother, and here we can hear some of that.
My mother was just so incredibly thrifty, and she worked so hard. She would leave at 5 a.m, get back after midnight, working job after job after job, scrubbing floors, cleaning toilets. She did not like the idea of welfare because she noticed that no one she ever saw go on it came off of it, and she didn't want to be dependent on other people. And so she was going to work as long and as hard as necessary. She occasionally accepted some aid, but for the most part was able to stay off of it. And she never felt sorry for herself, which was a good thing. The problem is she never felt sorry for us either. So, you know, there was never any excuse that we could give that was acceptable to her. She would always say, "Do you have a brain?" And if the answer was yes, then you could have thought your way out of it. And, you know, that was probably the most important thing she did for me and for my brother. Teach us not to make excuses. Because, see, if you can find an excuse for something, then you can wallow in the excuse. You don't have to do anything. And, you know, that's not what made America into a great nation.
And so that's how he began his speech, and it kind of set the tone for the rest of it. He kind of, sort of softly condemned social welfare programs, which he says allow people to, you know, not work as hard, or essentially. And he also criticized some kind of ongoing narratives in political debates of wealth inequality in America. When he talked about wealth inequality, he talked about it in terms of overregulations and businesses, small businesses being overregulated. And that's what's really keeping people from moving up the income ladder, rather than some sort of 1% control over, you know, the populace and the earnings of the rest of everyone. So here we can hear some of his rationale, I guess, for his view on that.
Every single federal regulation costs you money in terms of goods and services. It escalates the price. And guess who gets hit disproportionately by that? Poor people and middle-class people, they're the ones who are getting squeezed by that. That's one of the things that's driving the income disparities. You won't find the socialists and the secular progressives talking about that. What they'll say instead is the reason you're having this income gap problem is because the rich have too much money and they are your enemy. Oh, that's what they like to preach. But you can take all the money of the top 1% and apply it to these problems I'm talking about, it will barely make a dent in it. That is not the problem.
So you can hear his kind of views on wealth inequality there, which is obviously a national conversation. He talked about a bunch of other things, and he invoked a lot of imagery from the American Revolution and kind of the spirit of that. And he talked about, you know, Judeo-Christian values, and also in terms of monetary policy, you know, he wants to do more to eliminate the federal debt and deficit. And one interesting thing, well, I don't know if it really sets him aside from the rest of the Republican Party, but he advocates for a flat tax structure, so everyone, no matter your income level, will be taxed at the same rate, but he also wants to get rid of loopholes and so forth. He wants to increase the size of the military, which I think his rationale is that there is a threat of extremists, radical extremists, Islamic extremists, but also he really emphasized this idea of American exceptionalism and remaining strong in relation to other countries around the world. He went on to say with reporters that, you know, he's, of course, this week there was a tragic shooting in Virginia of two TV reporters. Someone asked him if he would support gun control, and he said no, but he does support services for the mentally ill, for instance. One reporter asked him what he thought about the Black Lives Matter movement, and Ben Carson, being the only African-American presidential candidate in the field, had this to say.
Well, I've been gratified that there are so many people in the Black community who understand exactly what I'm talking about and agree with it. And that's good, because people are starting to wake up, think for themselves, look around, see that the same people who are telling them, they're there, I'm going to take care of you, have not improved their situation one little bit. And we got to start thinking about the things that actually work, not the things that keep people in a state of dependency.
So, yeah, there you go. That's Ben Carson for you. Obviously, I'm sure a lot of what he said is contentious for others on the other side of the aisle, but he's, as you mentioned, Michael, gaining traction among the Republican base. And someone asked him also if he'd consider returning to Arkansas to campaign, and he said yeah.
Now, we've had some of the other presidential candidates other than Mike Huckabee who have taken aim at the former governor. Did he take any shots at Huckabee?
No, actually, I don't think Huckabee was mentioned once. Someone asked him, because I think Donald Trump recently this week had some nice things to say about Ben Carson or something. Someone asked him if he'd consider being a vice presidential candidate on the Donald Trump ticket, and Carson abstained from giving a yes or no. He said he wanted to focus, of course, on, you know, his current campaign. But no direct reference to Huckabee or any particular figure in Arkansas. He did mention that he went to the Central High exhibit across from the high school here in Little Rock right before his speech. And
the National Park Service Visitors Center.
Yeah,
Little Rock 9.
Yeah, exactly. I think he said he was taken aback by, you know, the progress that we've made since then and so forth. But he was, you know, like we said, hundreds of people were there. A lot of people were crowding around him, you know, trying to get his autograph, trying to shake his hand, get a selfie with him. But eventually, you know, he was shuttled off after making a approximately 2-hour appearance at the Capitol.
Well, probably safe to say a lot of people just excited to have some presidential attention from candidates.
Indeed.
So we'll see who comes next, which presidential candidates will make a swing through next time. A few weeks ago, the Arkansas Supreme Court Chief Justice Jim Hanna announced he would be stepping down early because of health reasons. This week, Governor Asa Hutchinson appointed a University of Arkansas judicial ethics professor to serve out the rest of Hanna's term. Sarah, you were at the announcement. Tell me about who the governor appointed.
Yeah, so the governor appointed Howard Brill, who is a legal professor at the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville. He has served as a special justice at times on the Supreme Court, so he has working relationships with the justices. The governor described him as an influential member of the legal profession in the state, said he had been on several state-level ethics commissions, and that he was an expert in several areas, had written the textbook on Arkansas law, and the governor had a lot to say about his strengths as a leader.
He has written Arkansas Law of Damages, the textbook in Arkansas on damages. He has written Arkansas Professional and Judicial Ethics textbook. Each of these are the Bible on for the legal profession, the area of damages and professional ethics. Today I had a text from someone that I was considering for this appointment, who I have high regard for, who's a sitting judge. And he said, I heard you might be considering Professor Brill. If that is the case, it's a home run. He said, as judge, I call upon him regularly to seek counsel. Lawyers across Arkansas have called Professor Brill on numerous occasions to ask advice. Judges across this state look to him for expertise, professional guidance as well. Besides all those enormous credentials, Howard, he loves baseball and he loves Johnny Cash. And when I saw that, I said, he's the right one.
Johnny Cash can't go wrong.
So, of course, the press in the room were trying to ask him to get a sense of his political leanings and, you know, if he had any thoughts on the recent conflict about same-sex marriage on the state court. And he said, you know, he wanted to leave the past behind him and look for the future. And he followed the Constitution and has a strict reading of the law. And that's his judicial philosophy, to the extent that either he or the governor wanted to talk about it. So has a year and a half appointment. He can't run again, but he is replacing the Chief Justice for this temporary period and says he's going to go back and be a professor again. He's taught for 40 years, so he says that's his plan.
It seems to me that the Chief Justice becomes in some way visibly the face of justice for the people of Arkansas. And that is a heavy responsibility. It requires education, it requires reaching out, it requires listening, it requires fulfilling all those roles of a judge in the way that we expect of all our judges. This is a wonderful opportunity. I am humbled by it, and I am pleased, Governor, to accept the appointment.
Do we know anything about any past opinions or any activism on his part? Is he necessarily fitting a political position for the governor?
You know, Michael, he served as on the Ethics Commission for former Governor Clinton. And so I know that he's respected as for his work as a legal ethicist. I don't know that he's a especially controversial pick from a political standpoint, and this is obviously a temporary appointment, but I will be curious to see how he is as a leader and what type of opinions he'll be writing as the court proceeds again this year.
All right, that does it for KUAR's Week in Review podcast. Thanks so much for sticking it out with us. We hope you enjoy the program. If you do, or if you don't, leave us a comment at our website, KUAR.org. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast in iTunes. KUAR News is a listener-supported service of, but editorially independent from, the University of Arkansas at Little Rock. We hope you have a great weekend, and join us next week.